This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about creativity as a factor in mental health with such a brilliant and endlessly creative guest, Lorna Collins, who not only has put out so much of her creativity into the world via mediums like painting and writing, also this has been an essential part of her recovery and finding an outlet for incredibly intense feelings, hallucinations, and other experiences that have taken a long time to figure out and unpick, really. And that's what I'll say on that for now, bit of a teaser. You'll get why I'm being a bit vague when we get into the interview. And this is a conversation that I so valued, and even trying to kind of concentrate on ordering my thoughts now is a little tricky because I just found the chat to be so reflective and I think really tapped into the non-linear kind of swirly existential kind of concepts and creativity that my mind is. And that's a contrast with putting things into words in ways that are kind of more concrete and linear, I guess, is the word that I would use. And so what I'm saying here is, though our experiences are distinctly very different, I so enjoyed connecting with Lorna even more than I thought I would. And I was already hotly anticipating this interview. And so hopefully you also connect with this raw exploration of creativity and all the wonderful things it can be. I also want to mention in the episode, we talk briefly about schizoaffective disorder, and previous guest on the pod, Johnny Benjamin, has that diagnosis and talked about it in his episode. So I'll link that in the episode description if you want to know more about that one. Like many less commonly diagnosed conditions, it is one that there can be less information on. So that's an option if you want to hear more on that. For now, though, we'll get into this conversation with Lorna Collins in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Lorna Collins, and I've been asked to set the scene with an early memory or an early situation, which is very difficult because I don't remember my childhood. But looking back, I do know what it was like for some reason. It's a bit weird. But I do know that we didn't really ever talk about mental health. Mental health was a non-subject in my family. I lived in a very traditional way of life. It was idyllic childhood. You know, it was perfect. But the idea of a feeling was never present.
Yeah. And that's such an interesting contrast to have the feeling of it being idyllic and so much being lovely about it. And yet the lacking of, okay, what happens if it's not that?
It is strange. But now I see how my parents live and how the rest of my family are different from me. I'm different because I've experienced mental illness in a very extreme way. And I have to be present to my feelings. I have to say how I feel. I have to be really emotionally aware. Whereas my family, for example, my parents, they're really old and I love them greatly, but they are not emotionally aware. They don't deal with things in the same way that I do. I had to learn how to do things differently, but I can't expect them to do that as well.
And would you mind sharing a bit of what the idyllic childhood was like?
On a farm in the rolling hills. Lots of animals. I was very good at school. Apparently, I was really popular at school, which seems bizarre to me now, but represented Great Britain on a horse when I first time was when I was 13. I had dreams of being the first woman to win the Grand National. I had dreams of winning the Olympics. Everything was going really well.
Mm-hmm. And could you share then what changed?
Well, when I was 18, I was a jockey, so I was riding in races on a horse, and I had a racehorse called Paul, and I was going to do some galloping rehearsals, I guess, for a race, and I was galloping flat out, and the horse fell over. He tripped on a bandage and fell over, and I catapulted headfirst onto the ground, and I had severe traumatic brain injury. I was unresponsive. My father was watching, and he came over and tried to resuscitate me, tried to give me the kiss of life, and I wasn't breathing. He called the ambulance, and I was airlifted to hospital, and there I fell into a coma. And that was the end of one life and the beginning of the next life.
And so you had that moment then when you did die?
Yes, I guess. Yeah. I mean, I was unresponsive, but I was brought back to life. And eventually I awoke from my coma and I had total amnesia, which means that I forgot everything. I didn't know who anyone was. I didn't know who Lorna was. I couldn't remember anything about my life. And what followed was a long period of me trying to recover from the damage done to my brain, which then became damage to my mind.
Mm-hmm. And amnesia is something we sometimes see kind of portrayed in media, and often it's a very kind of heightened version, which is kind of used for dramatic effect. What do you remember of that experience of waking up and not remembering anything and the feelings around that?
In honesty, I don't remember many, many years of my life. So I have no memory of several years around the head injury. So I don't know what happened. All I know is from testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Like my mother says that when I was in a coma, she recorded a sound of all the horses and the animals on the farm. So recorded them to trotting across the concrete or whatever. So I had the sound of the birds, the hens and the dogs and the horses and all the animals. And apparently when I was unconscious, I listened to this and I would smile. So I was clearly somewhat there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was still alive. So I don't remember this, but this is what she says. And I've learned other things I did when I woke up, but I don't remember it. So it's very murky. It's hard to piece together a life which has been taken from you, but it's still there. I know, because I get flashbacks. Now, I don't get any flashbacks of time in hospital. I have no memory or connection with myself when I was in a coma or when I woke up. But my mother says that apparently, like, I couldn't work out how to put socks on, and I would try and eat an orange with the skin on. And when I tried to walk in a straight line, I would fall over. Things like that. But I don't know. It's very disorientating and murky, as I said. And there's not like a clear point where my memory begins. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very murky, because what happened was the brain injury made me very disorientated, and the physical stuff I had to get over and recover from. But then the mental stuff I had to experience, and it took many, many, many years before I could fully recover. It's all very indeterminate. So I can't really answer your question.
No, I appreciate that, because there's such truth there that it is so complicated when you have a brain injury for anyone to understand, you know, especially if you're at the heart of it. And certain things are so fascinating there, like your experience of being in the coma and responding to the sound of the animals, and yet that not necessarily linking to a conscious memory of them. You know, our brains are so complicated. And I can imagine how destabilizing it must have been to be in that.
So I can imagine that my mother said to me that they told Edward, my brother, that I had this awful fall. And he apparently came in to the room, to the hospital, into the room, and he started crying or something like that. And I can imagine it. You know, I can imagine like my family around my bed, and you know, is she dead or alive? Can you imagine that? I mean, oh, gosh.
It's terrifying. It's a worse nightmare for a parent. Do you know how long you were in the coma?
No. Don't talk about it. That's not the thing, mental health. Don't talk about it. It's not a nice subject.
To a lot of people, yeah. Yeah, that must be tricky for you to try and be piecing this together. And then also, it'd be taboo to ask questions about something that was so pivotal in your life.
Because I have written a memoir, which is not ready to be published. I tried to publish it, but then I realized I wasn't ready to publish it. And I asked my dad if he could tell me what it was like when he saw the fall happen, me have the injury. And he said, that was the worst day of my life. I cannot and I will not talk about it.
And for some people, that is the
works for
what
him.
You have. Yeah. You talked about kind of the physical recovery, and then the mental recovery soon became the thing that was at the forefront. Could you share a bit about that?
Well, with the head injury, I lost everything, and I couldn't control anything in my life anymore. It was all gone, and I didn't know who I was. So initially, restricting what I was eating became a method of me trying to take back some kind of control. So focusing on the food and numbers and my weight became a distraction. So I didn't have to think about all the things that I had lost. So I developed an eating disorder and was first hospitalized in 2001. So the head injury was in 2000. And then when I was in hospital, I learned an awful lot more about how to be ill, which is ironic, but true. And I also then began to hallucinate. So I was developing other symptoms, not just the eating disorder. And these symptoms were all coming from the brain injury. They were organic, but no one worked that out. No one pieced it together. And I was very depressed, suicidal, and desperate. Then I could sort of develop sort of a chain reaction of self-harming or becoming severely malnutrition, underweight. And I became a revolving door patient. So I would go to hospital. I wouldn't get better. I'd eventually be discharged. Something else would happen. I would do something to myself, and then I'd be detained again. And that went on and on and on. And I didn't receive any help.
Mm-hmm. And could you describe the types of help that were attempted that didn't work for you?
Well, for instance, when I was detained in London, I was forced to have electroconvulsive therapy, ECT, where they anesthetized me and put shocks on my brain, a damaged brain, which seemed to me a really stupid thing to do.
Terrifying. Yeah. Well, it is an odd thing that is still a, I don't even want to say a method of the support, because I don't know if I necessarily
treatment option.
Yeah, that seems to still be an option, let's say, that exists. And yet it is one that there is no clear consensus at all on how it helps. Just in some cases, the after seems to be better than the before. And so perhaps it becomes a, like, we've run out of things. And when I talk about mental health and try and reduce stigma, that is one of those things that really doesn't help the cause, that there's this thing that doctors can still go to, not all of them, but some of them, of, we're out of other things, let's try this one, we don't know how it works, but let's give it a shot, really doesn't fill you with confidence of the mental health system, right?
Well, it's diabolical. I just had a brain injury a year before, and they decide to call me treatment-resistant schizophrenia. That's what they called me. They said I had that disease and that I was not responding to treatment, so they did not know what to do. So they put electric shocks on my brain. And what happened was it caused my memory problems to get an awful lot worse. So I forgot I was unwell. I forgot everything about the illness. And I convinced them that I was better. So they discharged me. And then I immediately relapsed, much worse.
Wow.
That worked.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe in the short term, it looked like it did work, because you didn't remember you were ill.
Yeah.
It's so odd to think about. And so through this time, I know from your wonderful TED talk that something that was kind of a consistent outlet for you was finding ways to be creative. That whatever else was being kind of tried out, whatever kind of constant, it sounds like, stream of different diagnoses were being thrown, because creativity was something that you found.
Absolutely. So my painting, right, and my writing, and in later years, my filmmaking have been utterly essential methods of allowing me to be present in the moment of torture that I was experiencing. So I was able somehow to express myself in words or in colours. And I found it utterly essential to paint and write every day when I was in hospital, particularly when I was in hospital. And I often found my paintings would go through different phases. So Often they were black and red and really sort of trembling anger and horror. And I would be lying on the floor in the room and in my room and just expressing myself and painting on the walls. People hated me for doing that, but I did it. I painted on the walls, painted everywhere just to get it out, you know. And with words, I find sometimes I still do this. I think in rhyme. So I'm thinking and the words rhyme. And I find when I'm unwell or have an extreme emotion, I find poetry just reels out of me. It just comes out of me. I have all these poems. I've written an anthology of poetry called Being Sedated. But no, the art is essential because it allows me to express what I cannot say in words. It allows me to open parts of my body and my mind that are inaccessible. It allows me to stop the thoughts and express them in a way that I can then understand, that I can show to other people, and they can then understand a bit about me. And it also sets me free from the pain of the emotions.
That's so well articulated. And even just coming onto the theme of creativity, I see how much it lights you up. You know, yet that was something that was kind of ignored and overlooked in your treatment.
Yes. They thought it was a bit annoying, the doctors and nurses, because I'd make such a mess. But
And I'm assuming, and they would give you the kind of tools to create with, right? Be like, please take this notebook, not this wall.
They gave me paper in the end, so it was all right. No, well, I guess the doctors in various hospitals, they realised that art was absolutely really important for me. So eventually they allowed me the space and the time to listen. To listen to me, what I was saying, and to paint. I mean, when I was in Cambridge, although the treatment there was hugely problematic, I guess I'm grateful that I guess survived. So maybe they helped me survive. But the painting I did in Cambridge was utterly essential because the doctor in Cambridge, one of the doctors, used what I created as a method of diagnosing and medicating and treating my illness. And then art became on my list of medication in Cambridge.
I love that. That's something I've heard you talk about in the TED Talk, actually, very movingly, that moment of being seen by that particular doctor and it finally being acknowledged how essential this was to your treatment. And really that it did form a lot of clues when you were having these hallucinations that you didn't know how to communicate, that other people, of course, could not see, that art was really the only way you could put across what you were experiencing. Would you mind sharing a bit about the hallucinations and then also that moment of acknowledgement from the doctor?
So I have experienced hallucinations, visual, audible and tactile hallucinations following the brain injury. And later I will go on to say that they are physically linked to the brain injury. But at the moment I see animals and creatures that come up to me and talk to me. During my illness, I would see people and creatures randomly, physically, like entering my space and coming up and telling me that I needed to cut myself and destroy myself and die, and telling me in very visceral terms how I should destroy myself. Also, for example, I would go to an exhibition and there was a Rothko exhibition at Tate Modern. This is one example. And the paintings, I mean, yes, Rothko is hugely expressive and emotive, but the paintings would become animate objects and start wailing and crying in front of me. Also, I would feel that there were creepy crawlies on my skin. And I had this one creature called Darkness Clings, who was an old man, and he would come and shout at me. And then he would wrap barbed wire around my neck. So that's the kind of sort of very violent, visceral kind of sensationscape that I would experience during my illness.
It sounds so terrifying. And it was something that went on for a while. Did you ever kind of strangely get numb or used to it? Or was it always kind of so aggressively felt?
I've never been numb in my entire life. Numb is a weird concept. I'm so springy with data. But although I have elements of my hallucinations that return and repeat, also, and essentially, what makes me different with my hallucinations is that they are continually creative and different. So I'm never bored or numb to something because it's always slightly different.
Yeah.
And they have evolved over time. Like, I don't see darkness clings anymore. I don't see nasty creatures that are trying to kill me anymore. But my hallucinations, and this is a crucial point, are like beacons. So that when I haven't paid enough attention to my emotions, or if I'm not really allowing myself time to be creative, or there's some difficult things going on in my life, if I'm stressed and I'm not doing anything about it, my hallucinations then actually become more violent and they become a bit scary again. So it's like, oh, hang on.
Yeah. It's powerful that you can see that correlation so clearly now, that they've become a tool for you, you know, something that is so kind of threatening and uncontrollable. There's something in it you found. And seemingly creativity was a way of honing that, of a way of putting them on the page where they could perhaps seem somewhat more manageable to see them and to have them, to be able to scrunch it up, to be able to put it away and take it out. And I want to go to that moment we mentioned of, you know, when that doctor came across you doing this and realized what it was doing for you.
At that moment, I was doing a very detailed drawing of Darkness Clings, the man who wraps the barbed wire around my neck. And I was not drawing him. I was just drawing what that tactile sensation felt like. And it was very upsetting. But the doctor, I really liked that doctor. And unfortunately, he died soon after this. I think he took his own life, which is very sad. But he saw the painting, the drawing, and he said, I see you, Lorna. And I felt really, for the first time in my whole life, completely heard and understood. And then he was able to diagnose me with schizoaffective disorder, which is a bit like schizophrenia and depression at the same time, which isn't, that's how I interpreted that diagnosis. I think it has a longer interpretation and meaning, schizoaffective disorder, but I interpreted it in my case to be a sort of suffering from a combination of a psychosis and a mood disorder. And I had that diagnosis for several years, and it was very helpful. I found it very helpful because it felt like I was being validated, and I wasn't making it up. I had a proper diagnosis that seemed to understand what was going on in my head. And they then increased my medication and gave me more antipsychotic and anti-epileptic, various things. And then they put on the bottom of my prescription art as medicine, painting. So from that moment, I was encouraged to paint every morning. And painting then became my go-to coping mechanism. So when I felt unsafe or I felt upset or felt that I should self-harm because of the voices and stuff, what I would do is, instead of trying to hurt myself, I would get out my paint and paint a picture or just express abstract colours and emotions. And that really helped. Really helped. It calmed me down. It got me to focus on something other than on the unsafety of my situation. And I was able to learn that I didn't have to self-harm to cope with my emotions.
Mm-hmm. That must have been such a breakthrough for you.
It was a breakthrough. The breakthrough didn't last very long because I was still unwell and I hadn't reached the end of my sort of journey. The journey took another sort of, I don't know, many years, but it was a big moment in my journey. And I then continued to use art as a coping mechanism, and it continued to be absolutely crucial for me. So the journey wasn't over. I still had a lot of learning and growing and recovering to do, but that was definitely a really important moment for me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember watching your TED talk, and it made me emotional to hear that experience of being seen, that so many of us are craving that. And I think sometimes this can be overlooked. I'm very much here for the support that the medical model can give us, but I also never want that to negate what are sometimes like unfairly described as like soft skills, like empathy, like, you know, acknowledging the compassion, the place that other people are in. because it's so powerful. And oftentimes it's also one of the greatest tools we have in our own recovery, is learning to be compassionate to ourselves, learning to be forgiving, kind of building these tools like muscles.
I think empathy and compassion are the reasons why I don't regret anything that's happened to me and all the trauma I have experienced over the years. Because often people say to me, oh, don't you regret having a head injury? And I say no, because although I have experienced such trauma and difficulties and pain, I have also learned a heightened degree of empathy and compassion, which is my savior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and such a tool, you know, not only for yourself, but I'm sure connecting to others.
Absolutely.
You know, becoming a writer, getting to share your creativity in so many forms with other people.
Yeah, I love connecting with other people.
Yeah, no, same. I really think it's, you know, sometimes I have these existential moments of what is life for? And that is the thing I usually come back to is, you know, I don't know what happens in the end to us. But I think, you know, while we're alive, while we're on this earth, if we can try and look after each other and make other people's lives a little bit better, that feels so meaningful to me.
It's very powerful and empowering.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because also it's very achievable. You know, looking out for other people, showing care to ourselves and others, we can all access that. I also have my own memory stuff. Mine is linked to depression.
That's another thing. Memory loss is linked to mental illness or mental struggles, because I know another reason why I lost so much memory over the years is because I was firstly so physically unwell from malnutrition, but also mentally, like in crisis, you can't remember crisis very easily. So it's added to the brain injury.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I can imagine that, you know, makes it even more kind of nuanced to deal with the memory issues of what is caused by one and what of the other. And it's something that I don't think we talk about enough. I think there can be sometimes a shame that can come along with memory loss, a feeling that in some way it's a defect of ours, even though it is often explainable. You know, I know that's kind of different in your case, but I'm thinking in terms of specifically, you know, I think all forms of memory loss caused by traumatic events, we can feel that we should be able to remember, when in fact it often is our brain protecting us, or it is a very honest reflection of we weren't able to take in what was happening to us. It was too overwhelming.
Well, absolutely, because I feel some of the things that happened to me in the hospitals, which are unmentionable, I can't remember, but I know they happened. Yeah. And I doubt myself. Maybe I'm making it up. If I can't remember it, perhaps it didn't happen, but I know it happened, but maybe it didn't happen. You know, you don't have that sort of firm validity. You can't sort of fix it, but you don't want to remember it. But, you know, it might validate you if you did remember it, but you don't want to remember it. Oh, you know what I mean?
It's exhausting. Know? Yeah, exactly. Would you even want to remember it? And, you know, then we can feel conflicted about that. And yet the reality, I think, for everyone is memory is fallible. Yeah. You know, like something that I know is being talked about a lot in pop culture at the moment is the Mandela effect. This idea of like a lot of people collectively misremembering things. Yeah. And so like one of the ways it kind of comes out in like social media conversation is like logos, that sometimes people will misremember logos, and seemingly a lot of people can have the same experience of that. And we're not really sure why that happens. Sometimes our brain kind of might simplify something, and then we see what it actually is, and we're like, oh, I didn't remember there was blue in that one, because maybe the red
not,
and the green were more
sheltered. It's not a conscious thing, so it's our brain misremembering it rather than our mind. But then what's the difference in mind and brain? They're the same thing, they're intertwined. That's another
absolutely. But I think, you know, what I'm getting at here is that memory is always fallible. A random one that I have is, you know, the chain coffee shop, Cafe Nero.
Yeah.
I was convinced there was only one F in that.
Yes.
And I really tried to find online. There was one particular day when I was younger where I was like, is this a conspiracy? Have they changed it and then like covered it up? Because they, you know, they very successfully changed the branding and they wanted to scrub the old one from the internet. And
really?
The answer is no. The answer is it always had two Fs, and maybe my brain and my dyslexia kind of simplified that and I knew it was read as cafe, and so I never remembered the extra F. And strangely, I'm not the only person that has that.
I can relate to that.
Yeah. Our minds are so fascinating, and I think sometimes they can feel quite ridiculous to us. Yeah, I've found a kind of strange affection for our own fallibility.
Well, that's a great learning lesson, isn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't have to make sense for us to love it. And, you know, when you look back on your own experiences, I wanted to ask you about how you've got to where you are now. And so where has art and creativity led you to in terms of your mental health? And what other tools do you employ to keep yourself well?
So in 2017, eventually, finally, somehow, due to luck, I was in the catchment area, living in the catchment area of Oxford Health. And I was admitted to the Warnford Hospital, Cotswold House ward. And there my recovery began. So they put art and creativity as part of my treatment program. So I was encouraged to paint and write as methods of getting better. For example, I realized that I didn't want to be unwell. Well, firstly, I realized I was unwell. Secondly, I realized I didn't want to be unwell. Thirdly, realized that maybe things could be different. And then I used my imagination to consider how I could make changes in my life, how I could get better. And then I used art and creativity to design and build a new version of myself and my body. And how does she do that, you might be thinking? Well, I just played around in my head and I imagined what I wanted with my life and what I wanted to do in my life, rather than just being ill. Having been ill by this point for 17 years, 18 years, you know, I started imagining, and then I would write and I would paint and I would discuss using my artworks with the medical team. Then the slow, long process of getting better began. So my recovery took probably 5 years, because there was an awful lot to work through and you know, resolve. And I had to recover both physically and mentally. So physically, I had to get a healthy body, get to a healthy weight. Mentally, I had to go through all the trauma and work out new methods of getting over triggers and problems. And art was really helpful for me, because I was able to express, as I said before, express what I couldn't say and work through those awful things that had happened to me. And then I began working for the NHS as a peer support worker. So using my lived experience and my sort of application of creativity to help other patients. Now, that job was a complete disaster, because I was tokenized as someone who was unwell. And so I became Lorna, who had an eating disorder, even though by that point I was recovered, but I became known as someone who had experienced an eating disorder and psychosis. I realized I don't want to be known as that person. I don't want to be known as the person who's been ill. I want to be known as the person who's well. So then I went back into academia, because one thing I missed out from my story is that I did a PhD at Cambridge whilst being very unwell somehow. That's a long story. And then I worked in academia as a research fellow and as a lecturer, all the time advocating the arts and creativity, and arts and health became a notion. So arts and health is a big field in university life, you know, academia. Arts and health is how we use art to improve people's health and maintain good health. So arts and health became my career, whilst making art and writing about art and being creative sustained my whole life. And then I realized that I didn't think my hallucinations told me it's very hard to be an academic and creative at the same time. That's another story.
Do you believe that? Because my mum is, she's recently retired, but much of her life was in academia. And since retiring, one of the first things she's done is take up a creative writing course. And similarly, like my dad, I think, kind of missed that, being in the world of medicine, missed the opportunities to be creative. Is that something you do feel, that, you know, it can stifle creativity?
I went into my dream job as a lecturer in creative health, and it was utterly my dream job, teaching the field of, about creativity and health. But I found that, and it was not the job's fault, and no one at the university's fault at all. It's my fault for being so sensitive, and I do not fit inside systems very well at all. But I found it very, very difficult because of the pressures and the bureaucracy and the administration and the system, the systematic constraints of working in an institution. It wasn't possible to fit in, practically fit in, moments to be creative. And the pressure also of and the workload means that physically there's not really time to be creative. And also the structure of the system prevents it from being possible. I don't know if it's not possible to be creative in academia, but I know that I wasn't able to be creative during that position. I don't know. I can't build a bigger argument than just me.
It's just interesting because I know it's a common experience that kind of pressure is definitely a part of it. But I interrupted you. You were talking me through some of your experiences.
Yeah. What was I talking about?
So you were talking about your career in academia, and that was part
yes.
of your...
Yes. So then I decided I was going to take a break, make a break, and live off my imagination. So I resigned from my dream job and, wisely or unwisely, became self-employed. And now I've written about 10 books since lockdown, books of stories, short stories, written for children and also new ones for adults. But the book stories for children are about animals, and the animals are to appear to me as hallucinations, but they're sunny, kind, and curious, and very much alive, these animals. And I write down what they say to me, and we have conversations. I write down their stories, and then I draw pictures and paint pictures of them. And my imagination does seem to be infinite, and I'm not being arrogant, that's kind of true. But I think we all have infinite imaginations. I think that's what it is, in a definition, infinite. I just think not everyone has the key to unlock their imaginations. And if only we could find that key.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a lot to that. And creativity exists in different forms. You know, I'm relating a lot to what you said about creativity as a way that you recovered with your eating disorder. And, you know, that's something I have experience of as well. People don't always get it when I talk about it, because one of the ways that I've been able to subvert my own pressures of how I think my body should look is by using my creative perspective. But it's not, brilliant, you know, creative in a like painting that somebody can see. It's in a learning to view myself more as a vessel for kind of housing who I am and my personality, versus being, you know, judged via my appearance in a kind of attractiveness sense, you know. So sometimes, you know, I'll talk about, like, you know, and I'm kind of joking and not joking, a lot of the times I just want to look like a shape. I just want to be a thing, an object. I like to wear kind of oversized clothes. I like to kind of wear longer sleeves. And a lot of this was stuff that I found quite organically, as focusing not on the shape of me in a conventional sense, but more so like, how can I just be a box, and then instead draw attention to changing my hair color and cut a lot, wearing kind of funky patterns and bright colors, and that be the thing that people connect with. And that's been a way of kind of subverting it for myself, but seemingly reflecting my creativity and my ideas of, okay, I want to try looking this way. I want to try this kind of anime haircut and see if it makes sense on me, a real person. A lot of that has been very organic in other people responding to me in a way that I feel more comfortable with, being like, I love your hair color, versus like, you're so thin.
That's fantastic. I mean, I find personally, before I get to what I look like, I find the physical contact I have with my art materials. So I say I'm sitting down and I'm doing a painting or writing a poem. I find my hands holding the paintbrush and playing around with colours enables me to make a connection with my body and the art materials, that sets me free from whatever I'm worried about or whatever I think I might look like. It doesn't matter anymore. I am pure creativity. It's liberating, and I feel at one, and I feel that nothing matters anymore. I am just pure flow. So that allows me to inhabit my body and use my body and be at one with my body.
Yeah. And I think there's such freedom in that, of finding like distinctly our own approach to our body and how we connect with it. And it doesn't necessarily need to make sense to anyone else, because whatever works for us. Mm. Yeah.
Oh, everyone is different.
And there it is. Everyone's different, but I'm glad that, you know, there's such commonality that we can all find like this as well. And so on that note, we will wrap up. And I want to tell the listeners about your latest book that comes out on the 23rd of February, called Squawk, A Book of Bird Adventures. And you have it right there. And so it's described as a joyous book, completely unique, and it's for children, right?
It's for children aged 8 to 11, but actually it is for anyone really, because it's the whole family will enjoy it, I hope. I wrote this book to it and I published it to encourage family storytelling, because I can imagine parents and children enjoying looking at the paintings in the book. Every story is illustrated, and enjoying reading the stories, which are hilarious, curious, and they have unexpected endings. And you meet birds like Flo the flamingo, who is a performance artist, and she has extraordinary adventures trying to make art in her adventures. She goes to a Buddhist temple to become a nun. So basically she goes to Chancelos and tries to meditate but falls over and can't get up. I won't say any more. Lots of random but hilarious adventures. You don't know what's going to happen. And hopefully people will enjoy reading what happens to Flo, the flamingo, and her friends.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm excited to read it. Thank you so much for your time and your insights today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
I'm glad. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.